Hello, this is Matt Ricardo in London, England.
And I'm Bill Barole in Santa Monica, California.
And this is Imagination and Junk, the podcast about the hard work of creativity, except it's not, because we are doing one of our semi-regular series that we've called I Might Be Wrong But, where one of us presents a piece of culture that we think is maligned and perhaps better than it is perceived to be, and presents that to the other one, who disagrees, and it just further erodes our friendship. So this episode is my choice, and we are going to talk about the 1980s science comedy adventure film, Real Genius, which, spoiler alert, it's great.
And I will be taking the role of the person who disagrees. I think right off the bat, you've already given this thing too much credit. When you were reaching for a descriptive phrase there, you went screaming right past the obvious one, which is typical dumb mid-80s teen comedy. Easy.
I think it was designed to be a typical dumb mid-80s teen comedy, but I think a few elements kind of got in the mix and made it a little better than it has any right to be. I think it's one of those.
We'll see.
We'll see. The opening credits, immediately not the normal opening credits of a dumb American 80s teen comedy. For this film, we get Carmen McRae singing the jazz classic You Took Advantage of Me.
I'm a sentimental sap, that's all. What's the use of trying not to fall? I have no will.
Over a montage of blueprints that show the evolution of weaponry.
I have thoughts on this.
Please.
Here's the top line for me on this movie. The top line is that it's a movie about a team of young super geniuses who are nevertheless too dumb to realize that they're making an obvious weapon.
That is exactly it. Because what they are is super geniuses in very specific kind of disciplines, but not so educated. They're not so worldly.
Fair enough. Like every young super genius in the history of these movies, they're maladapted.
So the opening scene, it does quite a nice little kind of fake out. The opening scene, it looks like a big budget kind of sci-fi movie.
Scanner on.
We see an astronaut in
target
a spacecraft
locked. Tracking lock.
Roger.
Firing a laser weapon on a single human target who is
right
sitting
there
in a chair on Earth and vaporizing him. This is then revealed to be a proof of concept video for a weapon that is in development.
The Crossbow Project. There's no defense like a good offense.
Mission accomplished.
Okay, couple things about this, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Playing the shuttle pilot is all-time great skateboarder, movie director, documentarian, and my former down-the-street neighbor, Stacy Peralta, who directed both Dogtown and Z-Boys and the fictionalized version of the story of the Zephyr skate team, Lords of Dogtown. Here's the larger thing that I don't understand about this sequence. You find out that it's this super secret clandestine CIA weapons program for which they have nevertheless decided to make a glossy promotional film.
The meeting ends with what I think is a fantastically chilling line. One of the military guys says,
Larry, let's see that film on blinding techniques. Then we'll all have some lunch, all right?
That's a good piece of writing. That's horrible.
Pretty good. That was pretty good. Before we leave the meeting, let's just review some of the dramatis personae. You have as the guy who is running the meeting, who I guess is supposed to be a CIA guy.
I guess.
It's a little unclear. Is played by a character actor named Ed Lauder. And his lackey is a character actor named Louis Giambalvo. And the thing that I found interesting about Louis Giambalvo in 1985 is that he is an exact dead ringer for a guy named Boris Epstein, who is a Trump lackey and, in fact, was the guy who was credibly accused of selling access to the Trump transition team. For the rest of this little exercise, I will, just because it's easier for me, I will continue to identify him as Boris Epstein.
That's fine with me.
Thank you.
So we cut to a school science fair.
Yes, we do.
Where we meet a 15-year-old genius, Mitch. Mitch is the protagonist of this film. And we meet his dumb parents, and we meet the absolutely spectacular and awful Dr. Hathaway. And Dr. Hathaway breaks the news to Mitch that he's going to be accepted into Pacific Tech, which is not a real university, but it's a thinly veiled version of Caltech.
Yes. Inscribed on stone in the administration building is the school slogan, which is not a real university.
Yep. My favorite line from this scene is, throughout the scene, Mitch's parents are being charmingly stupid. And towards the end, Dr. Hathaway says,
"Tell me, is Mitch by any chance adopted?"
And Mitch's mum says,
"Why, no."
And Dr. Hathaway says,
"It's amazing."
And she says,
"Isn't it?"
I love that.
Jerry Hathaway enters this high school science fair, by the way, and he's swarmed like he's a rock star, which makes sense because if there's one thing we know, it's that people reliably go nuts for the host of a local cable access TV show about science.
Yeah.
We know that to be true.
It's true. There's Taylor Swift and there's local science TV presenter in the pantheon of fame.
And as the arch-villain of the movie, Dr. Jerry Hathaway, we have William Atherton, who made an absolute career out of playing smarmy bad guys in the 1980s. He did essentially the same role in Ghostbusters and in Die Hard, where he played a TV reporter. He's one of those guys you love to hate.
He treads a fine line in being genuinely horrible, but also fragile and vain, and oh, I love him so much. He's fantastic.
And this is perhaps the place to note that over the course of this movie, starting in this very scene, Jerry Hathaway hits all of the bad 80s fashion notes in one movie. He just rolls them all up into one performance. In this one, he has the modified short-waisted sport coat with the lapels turned up. Matt, as a gentleman who dresses well, what would your position be on a guy who turns up the lapels of his sport coat?
I guess don't do it. But, I mean, I really like Jerry Hathaway, so I'm not going to diss him.
Later on, he rocks the sweater draped over the shoulders look.
Yes.
And still later, enters a scene wearing two shirts, a look that was later popularized by Steve Bannon, Trump henchman, well represented in this movie. And later on, of course, because it's a movie set in the mid-80s, he enters a scene jogging in a tracksuit and the obligatory headband.
To which he's greeted by Val Kilmer's character that we haven't got to yet. Good morning, your joggingness.
Yep.
So, talking of which, in our next scene, we meet Chris Knight, played by Val Kilmer. A young, ridiculously charismatic Val Kilmer, who is the crazy genius. If Mitch is the young, conservative genius, then Chris Knight is the slightly older, eccentric genius.
If Bill Murray hadn't aged out of roles like this by 1985, this would have been the Bill Murray part. He's the antisocial, wacky genius, the anti-authoritarian genius.
Yeah. I've written in my notes, yes, I have notes. He is wacky.
Yes.
He is wacky.
His principal character traits are two. He is a genius and he is wacky.
He's a wacky genius.
Also in this scene, we meet a functionary of Darlington, the giant conglomerate where Chris is set to work after college. And she is played by 70s softcore queen Patti Darbinville. I looked this up. This was 1985. Patti Darbinville's career in movies actually went all the way back to 1967. And her first movie credit was in a movie. Was in a movie called Erotic Salad. Yeah. And if I could just share with you the logline for Erotic Salad.
Please.
Quote, "Confined to a wheelchair, Martin Cliché is lost in fantasies of being a great photographer for the imaginary erotic magazine Fetish." And that's Fetish with two T's.
Oh.
And she in this movie plays a minor functionary of this company whose role is apparently to inappropriately groom younger geniuses. The character's name, we should say, is Sherry Nugel. I looked it up. Nugel?
Yes. Nugel, is that a name?
It is so specific a name that it just has to be an inside joke about one of the writer's sexpot high school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So her thing is, because this is totally real, is she's a genius groupie. She likes to collect sexual conquests of geniuses.
She has slept with seven geniuses thus far.
I believe so,
mm-hmm.
of whom this 20-year-old kid will be number 8, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing just has a little bit of a creepy vibe if you're, you know, paying attention.
It's a little predatory.
Yes.
I'd just like to go back to Erotic Salad.
Wouldn't we all?
How is the logline for Erotic Salad not no dressing required? I mean, come on. It's right there.
Yeah, they just left that one on the table. That's a missed opportunity.
I'm disgusted. Mitch arrives on campus and goes to his dorm room and meets Chris Knight, who he is sharing a room with. This is the genius meet cute.
Yep.
A tall, odd-looking man walks in, goes to the closet, goes into the closet, and vanishes.
Yes.
We go on to discover that one of the men we saw in the military meeting at the beginning of the film is pressuring Dr. Hathaway to develop the laser weapon.
That would be Boris Epstein.
Mitch goes to the lab and meets Kent. Kent is an asshole.
I think that's fair.
That's basically the entire biog of his character, just asshole.
And at this point, we have a brief expository scene with Hathaway and Boris Epstein, in which they drive out to Hathaway's weirdly fussy gingerbread house that he's expensively restoring in the hills outside of town. It looks like the house your Nana lived in. And for the rest of the movie, I was unable to stop thinking of it as Hathaway's Nana house. And I guess the implication is that he's skimming this corporate-funded research project that his lab is running in order to buy, what, doilies, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, doilies. Doilies aren't cheap.
No.
They arrive at his house and it's the first appearance of a brilliant running gag. Did you notice the running gag? Whenever Hathaway arrives at his front door, there's a stray dog that hassles him. And he always walks up to his house and goes, get out of here, get out of here, every single time.
I did notice it. I'm happy that you liked it. I did not. I think it was a lazy gag that they never paid off in any way, shape, or form. And as far as I can tell, the only reason for it to be there at all is that it was a quick shorthand and supremely lazy way to establish that Hathaway is a bad guy. He hates dogs. Look, he's mad at a Great Dane. He's a bad guy.
We agree. It's a good joke. And there is a payoff. The payoff will come in 1 hour, 30 minutes.
Not to that. Not to the Great Dane bit, it won't.
It's not a very big payoff. I'm not going to lie. So Mitch goes to the lab for his first day on the job,
mm-hmm.
and he meets Kent and Kent's gang. Kent is an asshole.
Yes. And he's a very specific type of asshole that was popular in these movies, the teen comedies of the 1980s. He's the preppy asshole. And preppy assholes were all the rage. They were reliable villains in 1980s teen movies. Although I would argue that there is a much better and legitimately darker take on this. The same year, in a John Cusack movie called Better Off Dead, it was written and directed by a guy called Savage Steve Holland. And the fun fact about writer-director Savage Steve Holland is he got his nickname when, at a school soccer game, he kicked another kid in the teeth.
Okay.
Born director.
Yeah, true.
And here, by the way, this lab scene is the scene where I've written Hathaway enters wearing two shirts.
Two shirts.
For those of you who are keeping score at home.
Kent's nose is put out of joint by Dr. Hathaway arriving in two shirts and telling him that Mitch is now kind of overseeing the project. And then we have, for my money, the best scene in the movie, where one of the students, whose name is Ikigawa, who everyone calls Ik, has discovered how to turn the entire dorm into an ice rink.
Yes.
Val Kilmer in tartan and earmuffs and ice skates pirouettes into frame and says,
welcome to Pacific Tech Smart People on Ice.
I love this so much.
Pretty good.
I love it so much.
It's pretty good.
It's the whole idea that these people are geniuses. They've got the big brains, but they're using them creatively. They are demonstrating the hard work of creativity. Thank you so much.
Well done. This scene also has one of my favorite lines in the movie, because I do have favorite lines in the movie. And one is that after Kent swans in to be an asshole, which is, you know, his job in this movie,
yep.
Chris, looking offended and saddened, says,
and we were going to make you king of the winter carnival.
Which made me laugh out loud.
Yeah. And Kent goes, what the? And then realizes.
Oh, aye, oughta. Can we take a second here to talk about Val Kilmer?
Yes, certainly.
This is Val Kilmer's second movie, and he was, at the time, I think 25. This movie is one of those moments where you are seeing a young guy at the absolute golden peak of his attractiveness and charisma in a way that made me appreciate Val Kilmer all the more. This is a good thing I can say about this movie. I do have some good things I can say about this movie. Matt, I'm not a monster. I'm not a monster, Matt. He is young. He is gorgeous. He is funny. It was a golden moment in his young life.
I agree with all of that. The character is smug and a bit of a dick and selfish. So it needs someone that is so good looking and funny and charismatic and winning that you forgive all of the dickishness and you want to be his friend. And he absolutely nails that. And if I'd seen him in this film and then never seen him in anything afterwards, I would have thought, how? How is this guy not going to be a star at this point? Clearly. If someone said to me, you know, back then, oh, he's going to be Batman. It's like, yeah, I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
So in this scene, we also meet Jordan, who, without leaning too hard into this, perhaps you can imagine the impact Jordan had on the young teenage me.
Tell me about that.
Jordan is fantastic. Oh my God. An odd, smart nerd girl in dungarees. She's fantastic, and she makes her entrance on a homemade sled crashing on the ice-covered corridor. And her first line, Mitch runs over and says, oh, are you okay? Her first line is,
no, not emotionally. No, I'm not. I'm disappointed. Not terribly, but still. It should have gone much further, much faster. It's okay, though. I know what the problem is. It's obviously the drag coefficient. I'll just have to redesign the lift. I can do that, no problem. I can do that here. But after they're designed, they got to cut them, and that takes tools. That takes time. Do you know how long this stuff's supposed to last?
Maybe another half an hour.
Oh, that's great. That's good. I can do that, no problem. Okay, what's your name?
Yes.
She's the best.
Yes, Jordan is kind of the manic pixie dream girl of this movie if you're a maladapted smart kid. She's a cute, hyperkinetic nerd girl.
Yeah.
Yep.
She mentions later that she drove her roommate crazy because she never sleeps. And then she says, I mean, really, really crazy. They had to take her out in an ambulance.
Once again, you're just cherry picking all the good lines. You're making this seem like a better movie than it was. Although, honestly, I have to admit at this point, you're maybe starting to turn me around a little bit.
Yes.
Starting.
Excellent. Mitch goes back to his room, and once again, he sees a tall, odd man go into the closet and vanish completely.
Silently, never speaking.
Silently.
Yes. We then have a brief scene with Mitch and Chris at the vending machines, where Chris is, and this, I got to admit, this is a clever bit, and it will pay off later.
Mm-hmm.
They have those 1980s vending machines where you could get a terrible cup of hot coffee by dropping a quarter in the slot, and it would brew the coffee into the cup. For you kids, that's how it used to work, before there were baristas and third wave this and I don't know what. So Chris is slicing slugs out of a roll of frozen liquid nitrogen with some kind of laser hacksaw. He's making perfectly sized and weighted hunks of frozen liquid nitrogen that he can use instead of quarters in the vending machine because he's an antisocial, maladapted genius and he's wacky. And that will pay off later. That will pay off. That's the thing they laid in that will pay off. So tuck that away for later.
I have written in my notes here in all caps, montage of college stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, baby. Mitch and Chris bond over lasers. And then I have here, Kent continues being an asshole.
Correct. And under all of this is a track called I'm Falling by the Comsat Angels, a track and a band which have not aged well.
You are correct. It's brilliant. Mitch finally finds where the odd tall man is going. Mitch finds the secret door in the back of the closet that leads to what can only be described as a kind of homemade roller coaster ride.
Correct.
And it takes, the car takes him on this little trip down into the, what they call in the film, the steam tunnels, which is, I think it's a phrase that only comes up in films. It's not a real thing, is it?
It is, in fact, a real thing.
Huh.
The steam tunnels were a real, still are, for all I know, were a real thing at MIT. So that's what they're referencing here, the MIT steam tunnels.
Incredible. I did not know that. Brilliant.
There you go.
So he goes into the steam tunnels. He discovers the odd tall man. He spies on him. And the odd tall man is doing something odd with envelopes.
Yes. That's all we know.
That's all we know. Chris goes to visit Dr. Hathaway, who reveals that he hates popcorn. Remember this for later.
Yes, Chris gets summoned to Nana House
yes.
for one of his periodic dressings down by Jerry Hathaway, in the course of which Hathaway makes sure we all understand how deeply he hates popcorn.
What's that smell?
Must be the dog.
That's popcorn.
Yes, sir, I know.
Get it away from me. I can't stand popcorn. I hate popcorn.
Yeah. In the words of Beavis and Butthead while watching a U2 video, this means something.
Exactly. This will come back later, friends. File this away.
Yep. Write it down. Hathaway tells Chris to work harder and that the deadline for the laser project has moved up.
We now go to a scene in the lab, Mitch and Chris working. And Chris, unbeknownst to Mitch, has diverted the laser in such a way that it bounces off a bunch of mirrors and lights up the whole quad, eventually going through a beam splitter to create a kind of floating neon sign in the air with the words, Tanning Invitational.
It's a Tanning Invitational.
We have arrived at the Tanning Invitational sequence, Matt.
This is the moment where this film is the most stupid 80s teen comedy.
Oh.
This is the bit where... shaking your head.
I don't know.
This is the bit that makes me kind of go, oh dear. It's clearly an excuse to have a lot of wet young women in bikinis. It's clearly Martha Coolidge saying, okay, we'll have this scene if I can have this scene.
Right.
There was a lot of that going on, I think.
Right. And in the midst of this bacchanal where they've taken over the college gym and created a makeshift swimming pool and there are all these trainee beauticians in bikinis bopping around to bad 1980s music, that jerk Kent sneaks in, like the rat that he is, and sees what's going on and scurries off to narc on them to Jerry Hathaway.
Like an asshole.
Like a rat.
So he goes to Jerry Hathaway, who is filming his local TV science show.
Welcome to Everything with your host, Dr. Jerome Hathaway. Funded by a grant from Darlington Electronic Instruments. And now, Dr. Hathaway.
Kent arrives and rats the party out to Dr. Hathaway. Boo, I've written here in my notes. Boo.
And this leads back to the party where Hathaway shows up with Kent in tow, yells at everybody, ruins the party, interrupts a nice beat between Mitch and Jordan, who are kind of vibing a little bit, and ends the party, ends the Tanning Invitational. That's what a bad guy he is. He ruins the Tanning Invitational. And that sends Mitch back to the lab. And Mitch back in the lab expresses his anger in the way that characters in movies inevitably do, which is sweeping some papers off a table.
Yes, stupid papers.
It's these papers. It's the papers that are to blame.
I'll pick those up later.
Mitch is so distraught that he ends up going down the hall to Jerry Hathaway's unlocked office, getting in, using his telephone to call home and tell his parents that he wants to come home. And because Kent is always lurking with his little posse of evil nerds, they're out in the hall, they overhear this, they magically procure a tape recorder, and they record the call.
So yes, the next day in the lunchroom, Kent, who is an asshole, plays the recorded conversation. And as always happens in films like this, when something like this happens, everyone just immediately turns heel. Everyone just points and laughs. So Mitch storms away. Horrible thing to happen. Trauma event.
Inciting incident.
Inciting incident indeed. He wants to leave, but Chris pep talks him. Chris tells him about the man who lives in the closet. The great Laszlo Holyfield.
Yes. He tells him why Laszlo Holyfield cracked. That he was all work and no play, or as Chris puts it,
all science, no philosophy. So then one day, someone tells him that the stuff that he was making was killing people.
Which is exactly the kind of manipulation that's being played out on Chris and Mitch and their team. And somehow it never occurs to Chris, who is, remember, a genius, that he is describing the exact position that he's in.
Yeah. This is, I think, a perfect example of the strength and weakness of this film, that sort of glaring bit of dumbness that you just pointed out is absolutely true. But also, I think this scene is really good.
And it is a scene, I should say, where Val Kilmer is legitimately really good playing it straight.
Really good.
Yeah.
And then he says what for me is, like, I first saw this film the year after it came out on VHS. I have used this line at least on a weekly basis since then. It's a moral imperative.
Yep.
You have to get even. It's a moral imperative. I love that so much.
Yes, because it is, after all, still a 1980s teen movie, and you have to set up what's coming next, which is, and I've written it again, all in caps, with three exclamation points, what's coming next is revenge plot.
Not just revenge plot montage.
Yes.
So, the gang, I'm going to call them the gang now, the gang get their revenge on Kent by disassembling his car piece by piece and then reassembling it inside his dorm room where it only just fits.
Yes.
This is a real thing that happened. This is based on a thing that Caltech students did in 1940. They disassembled and rebuilt a real Model T Ford with the engine running inside room 49 of Ricketts' house, where there was less than 2 feet of space around the edge of it.
That's impressive research.
Thank you.
Somebody's been looking at Wikipedia.
I know, my nerds.
So they prank the shit out of Kent.
Yeah.
And he is appropriately chastened for 5 seconds, but essentially remains still an asshole. Next, we're arriving at the harmonic convergence scene. Chris is once again summoned to Nana House.
Mm-hmm.
And he meets the daughter of the Ed Lauder character, the CIA bad guy, who's there to tell Jerry that he needs to speed up the timeline in person because apparently phones don't work in the mid-80s. And the daughter is played by Deborah Foreman, who 2 years before, in 1983, had played the lead in Valley Girl.
Ah, I did not know that.
Yes. So in one scene, you have Val Kilmer and Deborah Foreman. It's the 1980s teen comedy singularity.
In my notes here for this scene, I have Chris visits Dr. Hathaway, meets a young blonde woman.
No, seriously, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, or more to the point, to you, you let me know, okay?
Misogyny ensues.
There you go. And of course, this dressing down by Hathaway inevitably leads to another montage time, all caps.
Yes.
Three exclamation points. They're under pressure now. They got to get the laser to 5 megawatts, which is apparently an unimaginable intensity. And, you know, somehow it never occurs to them that the pursuit of this goal, in the pursuit of which they constantly set the lab on fire, it never occurs to them that this thing that they're developing could turn out to be kind of bad.
Chris has been told by Dr. Hathaway that if he doesn't get the laser working at 5 megawatts, then he's getting canned.
Right.
So there was a montage. I've got here in my notes, montage of Chris working hard.
That's pretty much it.
There's music. They're doing stuff with lasers. Finally, they talk to Laszlo Holyfield, the tall, odd guy who lives in the steam tunnels, which I've just learned is a real thing. The envelopes thing is because he is using a computer program to analyze how many times he has to enter the Frito-Lay sweepstakes in order to mathematically be sure of winning a certain share of the prize. This is real. In 1975, three computer programmers used an IBM to generate 1.2 million entries in a contest for McDonald's, where they received exactly 20% of the prizes. This is why every competition now has reams and reams of small print listing terms and conditions. It's literally because of this one thing that these computer programmers did in 1975.
So this movie is practically a documentary.
I love that about it, because when I was a kid watching this, I kind of wanted to be that, but I wasn't American or smart. I mean, I was quite eccentric.
Anyway, the point is Laszlo can help with the exam because he has magically applied his steam tunnel supercomputer to gather every question that Hathaway, in all of his outfits, has asked on exams over the years, and he's going to supply them to the guys to help them prepare for the exam. So Laszlo emerges. Laszlo joins the team. Laszlo has entered the chat.
And when Val Kilmer asks him where those files are, he says, "I memorized them," which doesn't seem super helpful.
No. But it does lead us to the return of Sherry Nugel.
Sherry Nugel.
Yes.
Mitch goes back to his room, and waiting for him is noted high IQ sex predator Sherry Nugel.
I've written in my notes, again, all in caps, "Oh, it is so on now."
But no, it was not on now. She tries to seduce him. It does not work. And he goes to visit Jordan and tells her what happened and tells her it didn't work because he likes Jordan. Ah!
It's very sweet.
That's very sweet.
We have another beat of Epstein showing up out of nowhere. Where's the laser? Because again, apparently he can't place a phone call. Hathaway blows up at him because he's under so much stress. He blows up at him so convulsively that he almost flings off the sweater which he has draped over his shoulders.
Kent, and this is in all caps in my notes, Kent sabotages the laser.
Yes.
Kent is an asshole.
Kent sabotages the laser by the sophisticated means of smearing some schmutz on the lens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, to be fair, probably would work. Because it's a laser.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I'm no college-age super genius, but I think I could have figured that one out.
You could be Kent.
I could be Kent.
I believe in you.
Thank you.
So they all do the exam. Chris finishes first and leaves an apple for Dr. Hathaway, which Dr. Hathaway puts in the trash can and then explodes.
Yeah.
As does Chris's laser, thanks to Kent's sabotage. Kent is an asshole.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
They go back for the post-exam test firing of the laser. It blows up, and Chris is so distraught that he goes to the vending machine room, and he throws a tantrum, and he slams the refrigerator door shut so hard that the liquid nitrogen falls out of the freezer at his feet. He spots it. He's cracked it. He has an idea.
His version of having an idea is looking at the ice and then going, "Oh. So Chris has the breakthrough. They modify the laser. They say lots of science words about why it's going to work now. And then it works now.
This is the sequence in which, in the words of Mystery Science Theater, they put more science junk around.
The idea of a 5 megawatt laser, by the way, that is a reasonable number. That is a stupidly high number. And I'm pretty sure that even now that doesn't exist.
Hmm.
Although the Navy do have a ship-mounted laser weapon that can shoot missiles out the sky. That's the closest thing to this in real life.
Your Navy or our Navy?
Well, not our Navy, obviously. We've got clockwork boats.
So the laser works. It blows holes in everything on campus. The team is happy. They've reached 5 megawatts. They decide to celebrate with burgers, as one does. And they slide into a booth and they're having their celebratory burger. When Laszlo wanders in, Laszlo has figured something out.
Because, as we've been told earlier on, Laszlo is smarter than Chris and Mitch put together.
Yes.
So he figures that they've built a weapon.
And as he describes it, they're all, "Dude, what? It's a what now?" And you're thinking, "Yeah, it's an obvious laser. Thanks for catching up. It's about time. It's an obvious super weapon. Genius."
Yeah, Laszlo says, "You know, what would be the usage for this?" And all the gang kind of go, "Oh, there's a million uses."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could be used for anything. And Laszlo goes, "No, there's one use."
And it dawns on all of them that they've been played. They go back to the lab, and all of the stuff has been taken. The CIA has swept in. The bad guys have already taken it. Mitch is stunned. "He lied to us." And I'm thinking, "No, he didn't, you simp. It was a weapon all along."
Yeah, he just didn't share all the information.
Yeah, it was more a sin of omission, really.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is the lesson that science and engineering in isolation is very easy to make evil.
All science, no philosophy, as Chris told Mitch just 20 pages before.
He didn't listen to himself.
But you know what this means? You know what they're going to need? They're going to need a revenge plot.
Yeah, it's a moral imperative.
So they come up with the worst, stupidest revenge plot in the history of teen movies.
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it?
It begins, it just begins, mind you, with Jordan getting the idea to plant a radio transceiver in Kent's braces so that they can hide in another room with a transmitter and beam a voice directly into Kent's head. And Mitch, in a monologue, convinces Kent that he is the voice of Jesus speaking to him through his braces, and he gets Kent to spill the beans on where the gear has been taken. Just your average everyday genius stuff, really.
They follow Dr. Hathaway to find the military compound that their laser has been taken to. And then, while Dr. Hathaway is out at the military compound, they break into his nanny house and they fill it with boxes of something.
Something. Cast your mind back.
Yeah.
And then, somehow, these two college kids, these two obvious college kids, one of whom is 15 and a half, manage to bluff their way onto an Air Force base past the world's most lazy and credulous gate guards and sidetrack the test firing of the space weapon in such a way that, Matt?
Well, our heroes successfully sneak into a high-level military compound, one of which, you're correct, is 15. To be fair, they take the edge off the 15-year-old by giving him a cardboard mustache.
Yes!
It's really funny.
They basically painted a mustache on his face like Groucho.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
The heavily armed gate guards at this top-secret Air Force base look at the mustache and go, yeah, okay, you can come in.
Yeah, and as they're driving away, having got past the gate guards take a phone call and they say, look out for anything suspicious. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is a nice cherry on top.
We will, starting now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We won't apply this to anything we may have already seen that we could alert the next gate guard about. So they break into the compound and they replace the targeting chips with other targeting chips.
Sure. Why not?
Why not? They make their getaway, and the gang all meets outside of Dr. Hathaway's house. Meanwhile, God has been talking to Kent, and God tells Kent to go to Dr. Hathaway's house at a certain time, and then tells him to not go in.
God is very specific in this case.
Very specific, yeah.
Yeah, God's a micromanager, apparently.
So, the gang have gathered outside Dr. Hathaway's house. Kent has arrived and is standing outside, and of course goes in. God told him not to.
Yep.
And they've also arranged to meet the dean of the university that we saw right at the beginning of the film. And somehow they have managed to summon a congressman.
Yep. He shows up in a three-piece suit saying,
well, I was told there was a situation here of critical international importance.
So the laser fires, but they have changed the targeting. So instead of hitting the target, it hits Dr. Hathaway's house and it heats up all the stuff that the gang snuck in there earlier in boxes, which turns out to be
popcorn,
because he hates popcorn.
He hates popcorn.
Yeah,
he famously hates popcorn, this guy.
Famously.
Yeah.
The popcorn pops and gets bigger and bigger and destroys the house from the inside out, sweeping Kent out of the front door on a wave of popcorn. The laser then destroys itself.
Yes.
So Laszlo arrives.
Oh, yeah.
Now, again, I'm learning American words. Is this an RV?
Yes. Well done.
Thank you.
Yep.
We don't have that here. Laszlo arrives in an RV, which he has bought with his winnings from the sweepstakes, along with Sherry, who has finally found the smartest person, and they're going to go and get married.
Yep.
Let's
be honest here. She has finally found the smartest person in the world to have sex with.
They are going to get married.
Okay.
How dare you?
I'm just, it's her thing.
They are in love.
It's her thing.
Why don't you want Laszlo to be happy?
It's her thing. She's a genius groupie.
Blah, blah, blah. Something, something, steam tunnels. I can't think of the joke, but it's there if we look. my final paragraph of my notes, Tears for Fears plays, kids play in mountains of popcorn in slow-mo, everyone lives happily ever after, except Dr. Hathaway, who arrives to see his house ruined, and the dog that he's been shouting at for the whole film just comes up and stands next to him and watches it. Finn!
That's the payoff to the Great Dane thing?
Yeah!
And the end credits roll over not just any Tears for Fears song, but, of course, because there's really only one Tears for Fears song, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which for my money is the most perfect thing to have come out of the 1980s.
Yep.
And as the credits rolled on the shattered, popcorn-strewn ruins of poor Jerry Hathaway's life, I thought to myself, well, I kind of see Matt's point.
Yay!
I kind of...
Grudging acceptance, I'll take it.
That's the business we're in around here. Aim for grudging acceptance.
I think it's got a claim to being one of the best examples of its genre.
Fair enough.
I think it's very charming.
Yep.
It's got good performances.
Yep. It has its moments, I'll say that. The plotting is as anodyne as it's possible to be. But it brings you a young, gorgeous, funny, infinitely charming and charismatic Val Kilmer at the absolute peak of all of that stuff. So in the calculus of I might be wrong, but I think Matt squeaks through as a winner this week.
Awesome.
There you go. Hail Satan.
So we hope you enjoyed this little tangent episode that we occasionally have here at Imagination and Junk. We're going to be back very soon with an episode where Bill will present to me one of his I might be wrong but choices. And, well, we'll see how that goes.
I can barely contain my excitement.
We'll see you next time.
See you then.
¶¶